Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Emily of New Moon. Beloved for her iconic role as Miss Stacy in the classic television series Anne of Green Gables, celebrated Canadian actress Marilyn Lightstone now returns to the world of Lucy Maud Montgomery and the magic of Prince Edward Island to bring to life the unforgettable coming-of-age story of the imaginative young heroine Emily Starr. If this is your first time joining us, you can find all episodes of Marilyn Lightstone Reads at classicalfm.ca or on your favorite podcast app. And now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Emily of New Moon.
Chapter 5. Diamond Cut Diamond. Emily, who had been pointedly ignored by the Murrays at breakfast, was called into the parlor when the meal was over. They were all there, the whole phalanx of them, and it occurred to Emily as she looked at Uncle Wallace, sitting in the spring sunshine, that she had not just found the exact word, after all, to express his peculiar quality of grimness. Aunt Elizabeth stood unsmilingly by the table, with slips of paper in her hand. "Emily," she said, "last night we could not decide who should take you. I may say that none of us feel very much like doing so, for you have behaved very badly in many respects." "Oh, Elizabeth," protested Laura, "she is our sister's child." Elizabeth lifted a hand regally. "I am doing this, Laura. Have the goodness not to interrupt me. As I was saying, Emily, we could not decide as to who should have the care of you, so we have agreed to Cousin Jimmy's suggestion that we settle the matter by lot. I have our names here, written on these slips of paper. You will draw one, and the one whose name is on it will give you a home." Aunt Elizabeth held out the slips of paper. Emily trembled so violently that at first she could not draw one. This was terrible. It seemed as if she must blindly settle her own fate. "Draw," said Aunt Elizabeth. Emily set her teeth, drew back her head with the air of one who challenges destiny, and drew. Aunt Elizabeth took the slip from the little shaking hand and held it up. On it was her own name, Elizabeth Murray. Laura Murray suddenly put out her handkerchief to her eyes.
"Well, that's settled," said Uncle Wallace, getting up with an air of relief. "And if I'm going to catch that train, I've got to hurry. Of course, as far as the matter of expense goes, Elizabeth, I'll do my share."
"We are not paupers at New Moon," said Aunt Elizabeth, rather coldly, "since it has fallen to me to take her. I shall do all that is necessary, Wallace. I do not shirk my duty."
"I am her duty," thought Emily. "Father said nobody ever liked a duty, so Aunt Elizabeth will never like me."
"You've got more of the Murray pride than all the rest of us put together, Elizabeth," laughed Uncle Wallace. They all followed him out, all except Aunt Laura.
She came up to Emily, standing alone in the middle of the room, and drew her into her arms.
"I'm so glad, Emily. I'm so glad," she whispered. "Don't fret, dear child. I love you already. And New Moon is a nice place, Emily."
"It has a pretty name," said Emily, struggling for self-control. "I've always hoped I could go with you, Aunt Laura. I think I'm going to cry, but it's not because I'm sorry I'm going there. My manners are not as bad as you may think, Aunt Laura, and I wouldn't have listened last night if I'd known it was wrong."
"Of course you wouldn't," said Aunt Laura.
"But I'm not a Murray, you know."
Then Aunt Laura said a queer thing for a Murray.
"Thank heaven for that," said Aunt Laura.
Cousin Jimmy followed Emily out and overtook her in the little hall. Looking carefully around to ensure privacy, he whispered,
"Your Aunt Laura is a great hand at making an apple turnover, Pussy."
Emily thought apple turnover sounded nice, though she did not know what it was. She whispered back a question which she would never have dared ask Aunt Elizabeth or even Aunt Laura.
"Cousin Jimmy, when they make a cake at New Moon, will they let me scrape out the mixing bowl and eat the scrapings?"
"Laura will. Elizabeth won't," whispered Cousin Jimmy solemnly.
"And put my feet in the oven when they get cold, and have a cookie before I go to bed?"
"Answer same as before,"
said Cousin Jimmy. "I'll recite my poetry to you. It's very few people I do that for. I've composed 1,000 poems. They're not written down. I carry them here." Cousin Jimmy tapped his forehead.
"Is it very hard to write poetry?"
asked Emily, looking with new respect at Cousin Jimmy. "Easy as rolling off a log if you can find enough rhymes," said Cousin Jimmy. They all went away that morning, except the New Moon people. Aunt Elizabeth announced that they would stay until the next day to pack up and take Emily with them. "Most of the furniture belongs to the house," she said, "so it won't take us long to get ready. There are only Douglas Starr's books and his few personal belongings to pack."
"How shall I carry my cats?" asked Emily anxiously.
Aunt Elizabeth stared.
"Cats? You'll take no cats, miss."
"Oh, I must take Mike and Saucy Sal," cried Emily wildly. "I can't leave them behind. I can't live without a cat."
"Nonsense. There are barn cats at New Moon, but they are never allowed in the house."
"Don't you like cats?"
asked Emily wonderingly.
"No, I do not."
"Don't you like the feel of a nice, soft, fat cat?" persisted Emily.
"No, I would as soon touch a snake."
"There's a lovely old wax doll of your mother's up there," said Aunt Laura. "I'll dress it up for you."
"I don't like dolls. They can't talk," exclaimed Emily.
"Neither can cats."
"Oh, can't they? Mike and Saucy Sal can. Oh, I must take them. Oh, please, Aunt Elizabeth, I love those cats. And they're the only things left in the world that love me. Please."
"What's a cat more or less on 200 acres? Said Cousin Jimmy, pulling his forked beard. "Take him along, Elizabeth." Aunt Elizabeth considered for a moment. She couldn't understand why anybody should want a cat. Aunt Elizabeth was one of those people who never do understand anything unless it is told them in plain language and hammered into their heads. And then they understand it, only with their brains and not with their hearts.
"You may take one of your cats," she said at last, with the air of a person making a great concession. "One, and no more. Now don't argue. You may as well learn first as last, Emily, that when I say a thing, I mean it. That's enough, Jimmy."
Cousin Jimmy bit off something he had tried to say, stuck his hands in his pockets, and whistled at the ceiling.
"When she won't, she won't. Murray-like. We're all born with that kink in us, small pussy, and you'll have to put up with it. More by token that you're full of it yourself, you know.
Talk about your not being Murray.
The Star is only skin deep with you."
"It isn't. I'm all Star. I want to be," cried Emily. "And oh, how can I choose between Mike and Saucy Sal?"
This was indeed a problem. Emily wrestled with it all day, her heart bursting. She liked Mike best. There was no doubt of that. But she couldn't leave Saucy Sal to Ellen's tender mercies. Ellen had always hated Sal, but she rather liked Mike, and she would be good to him. Ellen was going back to her own little house in Maywood Village, and she wanted a cat. At last in the evening, Emily made her bitter decision. She would take Saucy Sal.
"Better take the Tom," said Cousin Jimmy. "Not so much bother with kittens, you know, Emily."
"Jimmy!"
said Aunt Elizabeth sternly. Emily wondered over the sternness. Why weren't kittens to be spoken of? But she didn't like to hear Mike called the Tom. It sounded insulting some way, and she didn't like the bustle and commotion of packing up. She longed for the old quiet and the sweet remembered talks with her father. She felt as if he had been thrust far away from her by this influx of Murrays.
"What's this?"
said Aunt Elizabeth suddenly, pausing for a moment in her packing. Emily looked up and saw with dismay that Aunt Elizabeth had in her hands the old account book, that she was opening it, that she was reading in it. Emily sprang across the floor and snatched the book.
"You mustn't read that, Aunt Elizabeth," she cried indignantly. "That's mine, my own private property."
"Hoity-toity, Miss Starr," said Aunt Elizabeth, staring at her. "Let me tell you that I have a right to read your books. I am responsible for you now. I am not going to have anything hidden or underhanded. Understand that?
You have evidently something there that you are ashamed to have seen, and I mean to see it. Give me that book.
I'm not ashamed of it, cried Emily,
backing away, hugging her precious book to her breast.
But I won't let you or anybody see it.
Aunt Elizabeth followed. Emily Starr, do you hear what I say? Give me that book. At once.
No, no.
Emily turned and ran. She would never let Aunt Elizabeth see that book. She fled to the kitchen stove. She whisked off a cover. She crammed the book into the glowing fire. It caught and blazed merrily. Emily watched it in agony. It seemed as if part of herself were burning there. But Aunt Elizabeth should never see it, see all the little things she had written and read to Father. All her fancies about the Wind Woman and Emily in the Glass, all her little cat dialogues, all the things she had said in it last night about the Murrays. She watched the leaves shrivel and shudder, as if they were sentient things, and then turn black. A line of white writing came out vividly on one. Aunt Elizabeth is very cold and haughty. What if Aunt Elizabeth had seen that? What if she were seeing it now? Emily glanced apprehensively over her shoulder. No. Aunt Elizabeth had gone back to the room and shut the door with what in anybody but a Murray would have been called a bang. The account book was a little heap of white film on the glowing coals. Emily sat down by the stove and cried. She felt as if she had lost something incalculably precious. It was terrible to think that all those dear things were gone. She could never write them again, not just the same. And if she could, she wouldn't dare. She would never dare to write anything again if Aunt Elizabeth must see everything. Father never insisted on seeing them. She liked to read them to him. But if she hadn't wanted to do it, he would never have made her. Suddenly, Emily, with tears glistening on her cheeks, wrote a line in an imaginary account book. Aunt Elizabeth is cold and haughty, and she is not fair. Next morning, while Cousin Jimmy was tying the boxes at the back of the double-seated buggy and Aunt Elizabeth was giving Ellen her final instructions, Emily said goodbye to everything. To the rooster pine and Adam and Eve. They'll miss me so when I'm gone. There won't be anyone here to love them, she said wistfully. To the spider crack in the kitchen window, to the old wing chair, to the bed of striped grass, to the silver birch ladies. Then she went upstairs to the window of her own old room. That little window had always seemed to Emily to open on a world of wonder. In the burned account book, there had been one piece of which she was especially proud. A description of the view from my window. She had sat there and dreamed. At night, she used to kneel there and say her little prayers. Sometimes the stars shone through it. Sometimes the rain beat against it. Sometimes the little gray birds and swallows visited it. Sometimes airy fragrances floated in from apple and lilac blossom. Sometimes the Wind Woman laughed and sighed and sang and whistled round it. Emily had heard her there in the dark nights and in the wild, white winter storms. She did not say goodbye to the Wind Woman, for she knew the Wind Woman would be at New Moon, too. But she said goodbye to the little window, and the green hill she had loved, and to her fairy-haunted barrens, and to little Emily in the Glass. There might be another Emily in the Glass at New Moon, but she wouldn't be the same one. And she unpinned from the wall and stowed away in her pocket the picture of the ball dress she had cut from a fashion sheet. It was such a wonderful dress, all white lace and wreaths of rosebuds, with a long, long train of lace flounces that must reach clear across a room. Emily had pictured herself 1,000 times wearing that dress, sweeping, a queen of beauty, across a ballroom floor. Downstairs, they were waiting for her. Emily said goodbye to Ellen Green, rather indifferently. She had never liked Ellen Green at any time, and since the night Ellen had told her father was going to die, she had hated and feared her.
Ellen amazed Emily by bursting into tears and hugging her, begging her not to forget her, asking her to write to her, calling her my blessed child.
I am not your blessed child, said Emily, but I will write to you. And will you be very good to Mike?
I believe you feel worse over leaving that cat than you do over leaving me, sniffed Ellen.
Why, of course I do,
said Emily, amazed that there could be any question about it. It took all her resolution not to cry when she bade farewell to Mike, who was curled up on the sun-warm grass at the back door.
Maybe I'll see you again sometime, she whispered as she hugged him. I'm sure good pussycats go to heaven.
Then they were off in the double-seated buggy with its fringe canopy, always affected by the Murrays of New Moon. Emily had never driven in anything so splendid before. She had never had many drives. Once or twice her father had borrowed Mr. Hubbard's old buckboard and gray pony and driven to Charlottetown. The buckboard was rattly and the pony slow, but father had talked to her all the way and made the road a wonder. Cousin Jimmy and Aunt Elizabeth sat in front, the latter very imposing in black lace bonnet and mantle. Aunt Laura and Emily occupied the seat behind, with Saucy Sal between them in a basket, shrieking piteously. Emily glanced back as they drove up the grassy lane, and thought the little old brown house in the hollow had a broken-hearted look. She longed to run back and comfort it. In spite of her resolution, the tears came into her eyes, but Aunt Laura put a kid-gloved hand across Sal's basket and caught Emily's in a close, understanding squeeze.
Oh, I just love you, Aunt Laura, whispered Emily.
And Aunt Laura's eyes were very, very blue and deep and kind.
Chapter 6 New Moon. Emily found the drive through the blossomy June world pleasant. Nobody talked much. Even Saucy Sal had subsided into the silence of despair. Now and then Cousin Jimmy made a remark, more to himself, as it seemed, than to anybody else. Sometimes Aunt Elizabeth answered it, sometimes not. She always spoke crisply and used no unnecessary words. They stopped in Charlottetown and had dinner. Emily, who had had no appetite since her father's death, could not eat the roast beef which the boarding-house waitress put before her. Whereupon Aunt Elizabeth whispered mysteriously to the waitress, who went away and presently returned with a plateful of delicate cold chicken, fine white slices beautifully trimmed with lettuce frills.
"Can you eat that?" said Aunt Elizabeth sternly, as to a culprit at the bar.
I'll try," whispered Emily.
She was too frightened just then to say more, but by the time she had forced down some of the chicken, she had made up her small mind that a certain matter must be put right.
"Aunt Elizabeth," she said.
"Eh, what?"
said Aunt Elizabeth, directing her steel-blue eyes straight at her niece's troubled ones.
"I would like you to understand," said Emily, speaking very primly and precisely so that she would be sure to get things right, that it was not because I did not like the roast beef I did not eat it. I was not hungry at all, and I just ate some of the chicken to oblige you, not because I liked it any better.
Children should eat what is put before them and never turn up their noses at good wholesome food, said Aunt Elizabeth severely.
So Emily felt that Aunt Elizabeth had not understood after all, and she was unhappy about it. After dinner, Aunt Elizabeth announced to Aunt Laura that they would do some shopping.
"We must get some things for the child," she said.
"Oh, please don't call me the child," exclaimed Emily. "It makes me feel as if I didn't belong anywhere. Don't you like my name, Aunt Elizabeth? Mother thought it so pretty. And I don't need any things. I have two whole sets of underclothes, and only one is patched."
"Shh," said Cousin Jimmy, gently kicking Emily's shins under the table. Cousin Jimmy only meant that she would better let Aunt Elizabeth buy things for her when she was in the humor for it. But Emily thought he was rebuking her for mentioning such matters as underclothes,
and subsided in scarlet conviction. Aunt Elizabeth went on talking to Laurie as if she had not heard.
"She must not wear that cheap black dress in Blair Water. You could sift oatmeal through it. It is nonsense expecting a child of 10 to wear black at all. I shall get her a nice white dress with black sash for good, and some black and white check gingham for school. Jimmy, we'll leave the child with you. Look after her."
Cousin Jimmy's method of looking after her was to take her to a restaurant down the street and fill her up with ice cream. Emily had never had many chances at ice cream, and she needed no urging, even with lack of appetite, to eat two saucers full. Cousin Jimmy eyed her with satisfaction.
"No use my getting anything for you that Elizabeth could see," he said, "but she can't see what is inside of you.
Make the most of your chance, for goodness alone knows when you'll get any more."
"Do you never have ice cream at New Moon?"
Cousin Jimmy shook his head. "Your Aunt Elizabeth doesn't like new-fangled things. In the house we belong to 50 years ago, but on the farm she has to give way. In the house, candles. In the dairy, her grandmother's big pans to set the milk in. But, Pussy, New Moon is a pretty good place after all. You'll like it some day."
"Are there any fairies there?"
asked Emily, wistfully.
"The woods are full of them," said Cousin Jimmy, "and so are the columbines in the old orchard. We grow columbines there on purpose for the fairies."
Emily sighed. Since she was 8, she had known there were no fairies anywhere nowadays. Yet she hadn't quite given up the hope that one or two might linger in old-fashioned, out-of-the-way spots. And where so likely as at New Moon?
"Really, truly fairies?" she questioned.
"Why, you know, if a fairy was really truly, it wouldn't be a fairy," said Uncle Jimmy seriously. "Could it now?" Before Emily could think this out, the aunts returned, and soon they were all on the road again. It was sunset when they came to Blair Water, a rosy sunset that flooded the long sandy seacoast with color and brought red road and fir-darkened hill out in fleeting clearness of outline. Emily looked about her on her new environment and found it good. She saw a big house peering whitely through a veil of tall old trees. No mushroom growth of yesterday's birches, but trees that had loved and been loved by 3 generations. A glimpse of silver water glistening through the dark spruces. That was the Blair Water itself, she knew. And a tall, golden-white church spire shooting up above the maple woods in the valley below. But it was none of these that brought her the flash. That came with the sudden glimpse of the dear, friendly little dormer window peeping through vines on the roof, and right over it, in the opalescent sky, a real new moon, golden and slender. Emily was tingling all over with it as Cousin Jimmy lifted her from the buggy and carried her into the kitchen. She sat on a long wooden bench that was satin smooth with age and scrubbing, and watched Aunt Elizabeth lighting candles here and there in great shining brass candlesticks. On the shelf between the windows, on the high dresser where the row of blue and white plates began to wink her a friendly welcome, on the long table in the corner. And as she lighted them, elvish rabbit's candles flashed up amid the trees outside the windows. Emily had never seen a kitchen like this before. It had dark wooden walls and low ceiling, with black rafters crossing it, from which hung hams and sides of bacon and bunches of herbs and new socks and mittens and many other things, the names and uses of which Emily could not imagine. The sanded floor was spotlessly white, but the boards had been scrubbed away through the years until the knots in them stuck up all over in funny little bosses, and in front of the stove they had sagged, making a queer, shallow little hollow. In one corner of the ceiling was a large square hole which looked black and spookish in the candlelight and made her feel creepy. Something might pop down out of a hole like that if one hadn't behaved just right, you know. and candles cast such queer, wavering shadows. Emily didn't know whether she liked the New Moon Kitchen or not. It was an interesting place, and she rather thought she would like to describe it in the old account book, if it hadn't been burned. But Emily suddenly found herself trembling on the verge of tears. "Cold," said Aunt Laura kindly. "These June evenings are chilly yet. Come into the sitting room. Jimmy has kindled a fire in the stove there." Emily, fighting desperately for self-control, went into the sitting room. It was much more cheerful than the kitchen. The floor was covered with gay striped homespun. The table had a bright crimson cloth. The walls were hung with pretty diamond pattern paper. The curtains were of wonderful pale red damask with a design of white fern scattered all over them. They looked very rich and imposing and Murray-like. Emily had never seen such curtains before. But best of all were the friendly gleams and flickers from the jolly hardwood fire in the open stove that mellowed the ghostly candlelight with something warm and rosy golden. Emily toasted her toes before it and felt reviving interest in her surroundings. What lovely little leaded glass doors closed the china closets on either side of the high, backed, polished mantel. What a funny, delightful shadow the carved ornament on the sideboard cast on the wall behind it. What mysteries might lurk behind the chintz-lined glass doors of the bookcase? Books were Emily's friends wherever she found them. She flew over to the bookcase and opened the door. But before she could see more than the backs of rather ponderous volumes, Aunt Elizabeth came in with a mug of milk and a plate whereon lay two little oatmeal cakes. "Emily," said Aunt Elizabeth sternly, "shut that door. Remember that after this you are not to meddle with things that don't belong to you." "I thought books belonged to everybody," said Emily. "Ours don't," said Aunt Elizabeth, contriving to convey the impression that New Moon books were in a class by themselves. "Here is your supper, Emily. We're all so tired that we're just having a lunch. Now eat it, and then we will go to bed." Emily drank the milk and worried down the oatcakes, still gazing about her. How pretty the wallpaper was, with the garland of roses inside the gilt diamond. Emily wondered if she could see it in the air. She tried. Yes, she could. There it hung, a yard from her eyes, a little fairy pattern suspended in mid-air like a screen. Emily had discovered that she possessed this odd knack when she was 6. By a certain movement of the muscles of her eyes, which she could never describe, she could produce a tiny replica of the wallpaper in the air before her, could hold it there and look at it as long as she liked, could shift it back and forth to any distance she chose, making it larger or smaller as it went farther away or came nearer. It was one of her secret joys when she went into a new room anywhere to see the paper in the air. And this new moon paper made the prettiest fairy paper she had ever seen. "What are you staring at nothing in that queer way for?" demanded Aunt Elizabeth, suddenly returning. Emily shrank into herself. She couldn't explain to Aunt Elizabeth. Aunt Elizabeth would be like Ellen Green and say she was crazy.
I wasn't staring at nothing."
"Don't contradict. I say you were," retorted Aunt Elizabeth. "Don't do it again. It gives your face an unnatural expression. Come now, we will go upstairs. You are to sleep with me." Emily gave a gasp of dismay. She had hoped it might be with Aunt Laura. Sleeping with Aunt Elizabeth seemed a very formidable thing, but she dared not protest. They went up to Aunt Elizabeth's big, somber bedroom, where there was dark, grim wallpaper that could never be transformed into a fairy curtain, a high black bureau topped with a tiny swing mirror so far above her that there could be no Emily in the glass. Tightly closed windows with dark green curtains, a high bedstead with a dark green canopy, and a huge, fat, smothering feather bed with high, hard pillows. Emily stood still, gazing about her.
"Why don't you get undressed?"
asked Aunt Elizabeth.
I don't like to undress before you," faltered Emily.
Aunt Elizabeth looked at Emily through her cold, spectacled eyes. "Take off your clothes at once," she said. Emily obeyed, tingling with anger and shame. It was abominable, taking off her clothes while Aunt Elizabeth stood and watched her. The outrage of it was unspeakable. It was even harder to say her prayers before Aunt Elizabeth. Emily felt that it was not much good to pray under such circumstances. Father's God seemed very far away, and she suspected that Aunt Elizabeth's was too much like Ellen Green's.
"Get into bed," said Aunt Elizabeth, turning down the clothes.
Emily glanced at the shrouded window.
"Aren't you going to open the window, Aunt Elizabeth?"
Aunt Elizabeth looked at Emily as if the latter had suggested removing the roof.
"Open the window and let in the night air," she exclaimed.
"Certainly not. Father and I always had our window open," cried Emily.
"No wonder he died of consumption," said Aunt Elizabeth. "Night air is poison."
"What air is there at night but night air?" asked Emily.
"Emily," said Aunt Elizabeth icily, "get into bed."
Emily got in. But it was utterly impossible to sleep, lying there in that engulfing bed that seemed to swallow her up, with that cloud of blackness above her, and not a gleam of light anywhere, and Aunt Elizabeth lying beside her, long and stiff and bony.
"I feel as if I was in bed with a griffin," thought Emily. Oh, I'm going to cry. I know I am."
Desperately and vainly she strove to keep the tears back. They would come. She felt utterly alone and lonely, there in that darkness, with an alien, hostile world all around her, for it seemed hostile now. And there was such a strange, mysterious, mournful sound in the air, far away, yet clear. It was the murmur of the sea. But Emily did not know that, and it frightened her.
Oh, for her little bed at home! Oh, for Father's soft breathing in the room! Oh, for the dancing friendliness of well-known stars shining down through her open window! She must go back! She couldn't stay here! She would never be happy here!
But there wasn't any back to go to. No home. No father. A great sob burst from her. Another followed, and then another. It was no use to clench her hands and set her teeth and chew the inside of her cheeks. Nature conquered pride and determination and had her way.
"What are you crying for?" asked Aunt Elizabeth.
To tell the truth, Aunt Elizabeth felt quite as uncomfortable and disjointed as Emily did. She was not used to a bedfellow. She didn't want to sleep with Emily any more than Emily wanted to sleep with her. But she considered it quite impossible that the child should be put off by herself in one of the big, lonely new moon rooms. Laura was a poor sleeper, easily disturbed. Children always kicked, Elizabeth Murray had heard. So there was nothing to do but take Emily in with her. And when she had sacrificed comfort and inclination to do her unwelcome duty, this ungrateful and unsatisfactory child was not contented.
"I asked you what you were crying for, Emily," she repeated.
I'm homesick, I guess," sobbed Emily.
Aunt Elizabeth was annoyed.
"A nice home you had to be homesick for," she said sharply.
It wasn't as elegant as New Moon," sobbed Emily. "But Father was there. I guess I'm father sick, Aunt Elizabeth. Didn't you feel awfully lonely when your father died?"
Elizabeth Murray involuntarily remembered the ashamed, smothered feeling of relief when old Archibald Murray had died. the handsome, intolerant, autocratic old man who had ruled his family with a rod of iron all his life and had made existence at New Moon miserable with the petulant tyranny of the 5 years of invalidism that had closed his career. The surviving Murrays had behaved impeccably and wept decorously and printed a long and flattering obituary. But had one genuine feeling of regret followed Archibald Murray to his tomb? Elizabeth did not like the memory and was angry with Emily for evoking it. "I was resigned to the will of Providence," she said coldly. "Emily, you must understand right now that you are to be grateful and obedient and show your appreciation of what has been done for you. I won't have tears and repining. What would you have done if you had no friends to take you in? Answer me that."
"I suppose I would have starved to death," admitted Emily,
instantly beholding a dramatic vision of herself lying dead, looking exactly like the picture she had seen in one of Ellen Green's missionary magazines, depicting the victims of an Indian famine. "Not exactly, but you would have been sent to some orphanage, where you would have been half-starved, probably. You little know what you have escaped. You have come to a good home where you will be cared for and educated properly." Emily did not altogether like the sound of being educated properly, but she said humbly,
"I know it was very good of you to bring me to New Moon, Aunt Elizabeth, and I won't bother you long, you know. I'll soon be grown up and able to earn my own living. What do you think is the earliest age a person can be called grown up, Aunt Elizabeth?"
"You needn't think about that," said Aunt Elizabeth shortly. "The Murray women have never been under any necessity for earning their own living. All we require of you is to be a good and contented child and to conduct yourself with becoming prudence and modesty." This sounded terribly hard.
"All right," said Emily meekly.
"And now," said Aunt Elizabeth, "I want to say that I am not in the habit of talking all night, if you are. I tell you to go to sleep, and I expect you to obey me. Now, good night." The tone of Aunt Elizabeth's good night would have spoiled the best night in the world. But Emily lay very still and sobbed no more, though the noiseless tears trickled down her cheeks in the darkness for some time. She lay so still that Aunt Elizabeth imagined she was asleep and went to sleep herself.
"I wonder if anybody in the world is awake but me," thought Emily, feeling a sickening loneliness. "If only I had Saucy Sal here. She isn't so cuddly as Mike, but she'd be better than nothing. I wonder where she is. I wonder if they gave her any supper."
Aunt Elizabeth had handed Sal's basket to Cousin Jimmy with an impatient, "Here, look to this cat." And Jimmy had carried it off.
Where had he put it? Perhaps Saucy Sal would get out and go home. Emily had heard cats always went back home. She wished she could get out and go home. She pictured herself and her cat running eagerly along the dark, starlit roads to the little house in the hollow, back to the birches, and Adam and Eve, and Mike, and the old wing chair, and her dear little cot, and the open window where the wind woman sang to her, and at dawn one could see the blue of the mist on the homeland hills. "Will it ever be morning?" thought Emily. "Perhaps things won't be so bad in the morning." And then she heard the wind woman at the window. She heard the little, low, whispering murmur of the June night breeze, cooing, friendly, lovesome. "Oh, you're out there, are you, dearest one?" she whispered, stretching out her arms. "Oh, I'm so glad to hear you. You're such company, Wind Woman. I'm not lonesome anymore. And the flash came, too. I was afraid it might never come at New Moon."
Her soul suddenly escaped from the bondage of Aunt Elizabeth's stuffy feather bed and gloomy canopy and sealed windows. She was out in the open with the Wind Woman and the other gypsies of the night, the fireflies, the moths, the brooks, the clouds. Far and wide she wandered in enchanted reverie until she coasted the shore of dreams and fell soundly asleep on the fat, hard pillow, while the Wind Woman sang softly and luringly in the vines that clustered. Over New Moon.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, part of the Zoomer Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. Discover more of Marilyn's readings, including Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Vanity Fair, Jane Eyre, and Anne of Green Gables, at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also support this series by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review. Marilyn Lightstone Reads, beautiful stories, beautifully read, for a crazy world.